Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by discussing media coverage of the so-called U.S. War on Terror. The United States is conducting what it calls counter-terror activities in 85 countries on almost every continent. According to the Cost of War Project from Brown University, over 929,000 people have died in the post-9/11 wars due to direct violence, and several times as many due to the reverberating effects of war. 38 million people have been displaced, becoming refugees seeking safety in another country or becoming internally displaced within their own country. 7,052 U.S. soldiers have been killed in post-9/11 war operations. An estimated 30,177 have died by suicide. Pentagon spending has totaled over $14 trillion since the start of the invasion of Afghanistan, with one-third to one-half of the total going to military contractors, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Raytheon. Today's guest, journalist Anjali Kamat, spoke with three longtime journalists about the so-called war on terror and what it's meant for people in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen. Anjali Kamat is a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Anjali has reported on the 2011 Arab Spring, the trafficking of contract workers on U.S. military bases in Afghanistan, and U.S. arms sales to Egypt. Hi, Anjali. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Thanks for your great reporting on the so-called war on terror. There have been so many reflection pieces, narratives on the occasion of the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Before we talk about your series, what has really stood out for you in the coverage you've seen and heard so far?
You know, there's been so much moving coverage that's come out on this 20th anniversary. And a lot of it has tended to focus on, you know, the pain and grief of this moment for, you know, the people in America felt, the people in New York City felt in particular, people in Washington, D.C., the horror of the moment. A lot of it has sort of, you know, focused on reliving the pain and trauma of that moment, you know, people's personal recollections. What were they doing on 9/11? How did losing a loved one, you know, have these reverberations across 20 years, or someone they knew, or something they saw, the trauma of it, or the health impact, right? We know about 400,000 people inhaled that toxic dust around Ground Zero. So there's been a lot of this that's been very moving. And a few other pieces have also tried to touch upon, you know, I think some of the impact, the larger impact of 9/11 domestically in particular, whether it's the expansion of the Department of Homeland Security, what that's meant for immigrants in this country, what that meant in terms of special registration for Muslims, what the Patriot Act brought in terms of restrictions and civil liberties, what that's meant for immigration detention, you know, for Muslim Americans, and just the whole host of changes that this brought for so many Americans post 9/11. But I think what I haven't seen a lot of, and that's kind of why we decided to focus on this aspect of it, was what 9/11 sort of set into motion in other parts of the world.
I think it's such an important point, because listening to your incredible, almost hour-long piece, it reminded me of the series we started right after the U.S. invaded Iraq. It was an open line to Iraq where we had Iraqis on every week. And then a couple of months ago, we had young Afghan journalists on, two photojournalists and then a reporter. And we had some listeners write in and say, I just didn't know that this was happening in Afghanistan. And so, Anjali, it's just so important. The other thing that your piece brought up is that you cannot tell these stories in sound bites. You can't tell them in a short TV or even radio piece. I mean, your piece was almost an hour, and it really does allow you to go deeper than most.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I'm so grateful to Reveal and CIR for sort of giving me the space to do this across the whole hour. And we had an amazing team working on this. And, you know, really, I think sort of thinking about it when you talk about hearing Iraqi voices, hearing Afghan voices, right? And giving people the space to really understand and relate to what's happening in other parts of the world. We live in a world that is so interconnected. We talk about this all the time, you know, but what does that really mean, right? And we don't often give ourselves the space to think about that and to think about how, you know, that the slogan that everybody talked about after 9/11, never forget. Who gets remembered? Who gets forgotten, right? What are the politics of what we remember and memorialize and what gets erased from our memories? And those are the kinds of questions I really wanted to grapple with in this hour and sort of allow us to expand our memory of 9/11 to include everything that it's wrought in places across the world. So it's the lives of Iraqis, the lives of Afghans, the lives of Yemenis and Pakistanis and Syrians and Somalis. Like, how have all of these people paid the price for political decisions made in the United States in a moment, right? After these terrible attacks of 9/11, a week after those attacks, Congress passed the authorization for the use of military force. And that's been the legal justification for so many of the wars that followed.
So you spoke with journalists about Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen, which doesn't get as much attention, although there are some journalists getting, you know, doing really, really good reporting out of Yemen. So let's talk about some of the highlights from all three. You interviewed Anand Gopal, whose book about the U.S. invasion was a Pulitzer finalist, and his New Yorker piece about Afghan women living in rural areas and their very strong opinions about the U.S. invasion has received a lot of attention. And Anand Gopal told you that right after the U.S. invaded, the Taliban were ready to accept defeat. He said, the Taliban said, we will put down our weapons, allow us to go back home, and give us amnesty. But as you said, Anjali, 9/11 was still fresh, and the Americans said no. So tell us more about that exchange and why that's so important.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we often forget, right, is what was actually happening in those weeks and months after 9/11. You know, the narrative about the Taliban, I mean, of course, we all know their very grim policies, the very harsh punishments they've meted out. They kept Afghanistan as one of the poorest countries in the world, incredibly harsh policies towards women. You know, that's the narrative we have. But then also after 9/11, as this was the group, this was the government of Afghanistan that was harboring Al-Qaeda and harboring Osama bin Laden. And, you know, President Bush gave the speech on September 20th, a couple days after the authorization to use military force was approved by Congress, where he said, you know, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. And the world has a choice to make. And that was sort of became the justification and the sort of the framework for a lot of the wars that followed. And what we had at that moment, what Anand chronicles so well in his book, is how that mentality of like, if you are not fully with us, you are with the terrorists. You are an enemy. You belong to be, you deserve to be detained. We don't talk to terrorists. We don't negotiate with terrorists. You know, that kind of very Manichaean view of the world into good and evil, and a sort of erases any possibility of engaging in politics, right? Which is what happens in real politics. And the Taliban was not allowed to sort of participate in a political negotiation. So you had quite early on the head of the Taliban offering to sort of give hand over Osama bin Laden to a so-called neutral third country, which President Bush refused. And then a few weeks and months into the fighting, you had another offer by a Taliban leader saying, you know, we are willing to surrender our weapons. Just give us, you know, allow us to surrender with dignity and allow our leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, to sort of have a life in peace, you know, in essence, give us some form of amnesty. And that was something that Donald Rumsfeld, who was the defense secretary at that time, absolutely refused. And this was not something that was acceptable. And this happened multiple times. There were waves of offers by the Taliban, both at the senior level and like different commanders at the local level within Afghanistan, saying, we're ready to give up. Just let us kind of recede into the background. We're not going to fight you anymore. Maybe we can even have a role in this new government. Let's talk about that. And that was just not allowed to happen. And, you know, when you think back now 20 years, the question becomes, if we didn't have such a black and white view of good and evil, right? Because part of what the story also does is talk about who the U.S. allied with in Afghanistan. And they were, you know, in many ways, incredibly brutal as well. We know about the brutality of the Taliban, or we know something of the brutality of the Taliban. But we don't have in our media as many narratives about the brutality of some of the other warlords, some of the other mujahideen who were anti-Taliban, who, you know, that then that's a story Anand tells a little bit of in his book. Also in terms of their very harsh restrictions on women, you know, not exactly feminist in any, by any measure. But those are the people that the US allied with, and they became the good guys. And then it just became a game of rivalry, where if you didn't like someone, you would say, oh, this person's a Taliban, right? And you reach a point by early 2002 where, you know, almost everyone in the Taliban has surrendered and wants to give up fighting. And there's no action, you know, most of the Al-Qaeda members have fled the country. But as Anand puts it in the show, you know, the US was still wanting to find terrorists. The US was in Afghanistan to fight a so-called war on terror. So they were giving out rewards to people saying, you know, find us Al-Qaeda and Taliban. So this became a very sort of, you know, understandable and easy moment for people who might have had personal rivalries and leaders who were suddenly installed as, you know, with people with a lot of power and close to the Americans to kind of say, all right, I don't like this guy. Let's say he's Taliban. And that's one of the stories we tell.
Right. Anand says the war on terror made many warlords extremely wealthy. Instead of eliminating enemies, this, quote, war on terror ended up creating them. And who is caught in the middle of all of this is ordinary citizens. As Anand said, going to a wedding or going to your fields, you don't know if you'll come back. It's literally daily terror. And he said that's a word that people describe a lot, terror, which is interesting for us thinking about the war on terror.
Yeah, when we think about, you know, 9/11, there's that, you know, memory of the horror and the terror of being under attack, right? Of the panic and the fear and seeing these terrible images of bodies falling through the sky. And that horrible experience of directly being under attack, I mean, so many people in countries that have borne the brunt of these wars have experienced that on an almost daily basis. And that's not something that is thought about as part of the legacy of 9/11. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this, because in Afghanistan, in the countryside, there has been so many bombings, air raids, night raids, drone attacks. And, you know, one of the things that really moved me in Anand's story and what he, in my interview with him, was that so many of these deaths aren't even counted. You know, the Pentagon, of course, you know, famously repeatedly said they do not do body counts of civilian casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, we rely on independent organizations and the UN to get an estimate of how many people have died, how many civilians have died. We don't have a real sense of how many people have died. And then Anand goes to, you know, speaking to this woman who takes him to, you know, this hillside. And all you have are these unmarked graves, just these stones to remember members of her family who've been killed in many of these operations. You know, this woman lost 16 members of her family during the past 20 years of war. And Afghanistan, of course, has been in a state of war for 42 years. So, you know, this is a place where there's been so many different histories of brutality that people are grappling with, and people are trying to survive and, you know, find their way through. And then to have this happen coming in at a moment where, let's not forget, you know, the promise was also freedom. This was called Operation Enduring Freedom. This was supposed to make Afghanistan a much better place.
Today we are speaking with Anjali Kamat, who's a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. She spoke with three longtime journalists about the so-called war on terror and what it has meant for people in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen. And I hope you can take the time to listen to this piece. It's at yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions or comments for Anjali, or if anything has really stood out for you about coverage of 9/11, specifically about what it has meant for people in the countries affected by this, these wars. Again, the U.S. is conducting what it calls counter-terror activities in 85 countries on almost every continent. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Paul in San Rafael. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. And I would like to point something out. It's troubled me since 2 days after that event. I've never, except for perhaps Noam Chomsky, heard anyone look at the underlying motivations that created the animosity that developed, that some the supportive and had that act take place. Nothing. We know there's a religious dogma that generally is an evil wherever it sticks its head up in any group. But what about the other reasons? I don't believe there's hardly any act in the history of the world where one side is completely evil versus another, except for some very minor exceptions.
So, well, thank you for this question. Anjali, I remember when this happened, and the question then was, why do they hate us?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then people started reading writings from Osama bin Laden, which included information around Israel-Palestine. What are your thoughts about this? I mean, I listened to a lot of coverage over the last couple of weeks and haven't really heard much about this.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real tendency, I think, in many places to sort of not want to dig too deep into the historical reasons why places around the world, people around the world might be critical of the U.S., right? And I think one of the questions for me is, you know, when President Bush framed this whole sort of moment after 9/11, with this question, why do they hate us? And his answer was, they hate our freedoms, right? Mm-hmm. A very simplistic understanding that divided the world into people who were freedom-loving, democracy-loving, and people who hated freedom, and people who wanted to, you know, oppress people. And those were the sort of divisions that sort of came to govern the world and the framework of so much of our policies. But there was very little effort or attempt to understand the United States as an empire and to understand what the long history of U.S. imperial policies in the Middle East might have meant to people living there. Now, of course, there's a very specific history to Al-Qaeda that is not the same thing as people around the world who might be critical of the United States. So there's the specific nature of Al-Qaeda and the specific grievances of Osama bin Laden that are tied to U.S. policy in the Middle East, yes, but also the U.S.-Saudi relationship also has to do with the history of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia that are all very particular, but also goes back to the Gulf War. And so there's different reasons that one can think of. But then, of course, a lot of people also talked about the fact that, okay, you know, let's talk about U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, U.S. funding of the Mujahideen, right? The anti-Soviet fighters. So there are different strands of explanations that people drew on. But I think by and large, it's a complicated and difficult history to engage with because it, you know, when we think of 9/11, we think of the pain and grief that people went through. And we also like to remember it as a time of, we like to remember the moments of heroism and resilience that people showed on the ground, which was absolutely a giant part of what people who were in New York City and in Washington and around the Pentagon kind of experienced that day as, and how they got through the pain of that day. But we don't like to think about, you know, the U.S. government, what it might have done in the past and what it continued to do after 9/11 and how it sort of the violence and the aggression that spun out across large parts of the world as a result of 9/11.
Right. Well, thank you for that question. Let's talk about Yemen, because this, again, there are some great reporters trying to get as much as they can out of Yemen, but it just doesn't get as much attention as it deserves. Well, first off, thousands of drone strikes have been reported from North Africa all the way to South Africa. And Safa Al-Ahmad, a journalist and documentary filmmaker, has spent years reporting out of Yemen, as you report a country the U.S. is not officially at war with. Safa told you, I know what it means to be afraid of being shot at, but this is a whole different level of fear that is constant. And she's talking about drone strikes.
Yeah, I mean, what it feels like to be living under the constant surveillance of drones and never really knowing when a surveillance drone might suddenly turn into a weaponized drone. And when you're hearing that buzzing noise overhead and you know you're being watched and you're not quite sure why, I mean, it creates a lot of trauma. And I think Safa really beautifully captures that in the story she told me, what it feels like in Yemen. And it's obviously not true just of Yemen. It's also true of Pakistan. It's true of Somalia. It's true of Afghanistan, certainly. And with Pakistan and Yemen in particular, I mean, these are not countries the U.S. ever declared war against, right? But part of, again, that authorization for use of military force, the AUMF, it allowed the U.S. government to go after, you know, it sort of created a legal justification for a borderless war. And one didn't need to get authorization. And these are sort of legal debates about this, but this is how it's been used in effect, is to, you know, if you find a so-called terrorist suspect in anywhere in the world, you could, you know, and you believe they might be planning in some way to attack the U.S., you could have the legal justification to assassinate them. And this has come under severe criticism from human rights groups and legal groups that have questioned the legality of this move. But it has, you know, been going on in Yemen. And President Biden is apparently studying these policies in Yemen. And we haven't yet gotten a new policy from him about how drone strikes will work in parts of the world where the U.S. is not actively at war. So we'll see how that changes. But even, you know, as recently as this summer, there were drone attacks in Somalia. And then, of course, there were recent drone strikes in Afghanistan right before U.S. troops left Afghanistan after ISIS-K attacked the airport in Kabul. And a family of 10 is reported to have been killed in one of those drone attacks in Kabul. So in Yemen in particular, I mean, there's reports of nearly 1,800 people who've been killed in these drone attacks, about 400 drone strikes under President Bush and Obama. This was a secret war, so getting any information about this has been extremely difficult. Most of this information is classified. There's no public accounting of exactly how many civilians have been killed. And there's no real sense of why someone might be killed. There are parts of the country where groups that are affiliated with Al-Qaeda and ISIS are active, but is their number one target always the United States? It's unclear. And that's some of the sort of complex reporting that Safa brings to the picture, which is like, you know, who are these groups actually fighting? The battle lines are so complicated in Yemen. There's a civil war with the Saudi-led coalition on one side that's been backed by the U.S. until very recently. And then the Houthis on the other side. It's turned into a proxy war, and Al-Qaeda and ISIS are in there as well. And so, again, this division of good guys versus bad guys, good versus evil, it's all quite murky. And how much do these people really want to target the U.S., or is their fight with each other? These are all questions that haven't been answered, and there are no easy answers to. But there was an escalation of drone strikes under President Obama and another escalation under President Trump. And this part of the country that Safa went to saw, you know, was rained down on by drones for over a year and a half in 2017 and 2018, where any male over the age of 16 could be considered a combatant. And then their death would not be even counted as a civilian death. But it was also women and children who also got caught up. So it almost made no difference what you were. And there was this constant sense of fear among people on the ground, and the sense that what is the logic behind this drone strike? You know, I think Safa says it in the episode. She's like, am I a terrorist? Am I not? Do I look like a terrorist to them somehow? You know, there's all these questions that people have, and there's no way of getting a clear answer.
Safa told you, I don't think Americans understand how powerful they are in destroying people just by claiming that they're terrorists or affiliated with terrorism.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the sort of key points that Safa makes, and that I think has been important to so much of the world, even far beyond places that have been droned, is how the framework of the war on terror has given countries, governments around the world, authoritarian governments around the world, a toolbook to basically, you know, you can label someone a terrorist, and you can essentially, you know, maybe they are in some way a militant, you know, part of a militant group. But in many cases, what we see in country after country is that they disagree with that government's policies. So what does that label terrorist mean? And it's come to be, you know, quite stripped of meaning in a lot of different places when it can be weaponized in this manner to crush dissent.
You actually have an example of this in your piece with Safa. She made a documentary. She's from Saudi Arabia. And can you tell us what happened when there was an official letter from the Saudi embassy in London to the BBC numbering, quote, all the crimes she's committed as a Saudi citizen? And this just speaks to your point about how other countries use a 9/11 language.
Yeah, I mean, Saudi Arabia, like many other countries, have been fighting its own war on terrorism. But, you know, the war on terror gave it this sort of framework that was now endorsed by the United States, which is much more powerful. And so you had, I think, a new set of laws that came in, anti-terrorism laws that came in post 9/11. And essentially, you know, Safa was covering what was, you know, this major uprising in eastern Saudi Arabia that was part of the Arab uprisings, but didn't get as much attention because it was in Saudi Arabia. And by and large, Saudi Arabia was seen as, you know, the Saudi government was seen as the force of the counter-revolution when it comes to the Arab uprisings. But you had this domestic uprising within Saudi Arabia. And so Safa, you know, very bravely manages to get in and cover this and make this documentary. But a lot of the people who are involved have been labeled terrorists by the Saudi government for rising up against them. And by extension, Safa is also sort of tainted with the same label. And she is accused of supporting people who have been labeled terrorists and accused of violating a number of laws. And this then makes it very dangerous for her as a journalist and a Saudi citizen to return to Saudi Arabia because of this label.
You know, Anjali, hearing your pieces, I just wonder what you think about this idea of othering, which allows the United States to bomb other countries without thinking about how this will affect Afghans, Iraqis, or in the case of drones, people in Yemen. I mean, right after after 9/11, it was about getting people in caves. You saw so many images of people with Kalashnikovs, people screaming. And the media did, you know, a really bad job of actually humanizing people living in these countries. And even today, you hear Americans say, we made a better life for Afghans. We did this. And it really doesn't include all of the stories of what the Afghans, for example, have done over the past 20 years, especially women, especially journalists, especially artists, who've really created, I tried to create, media outlets, you know, an arts community. I mean, the list just goes on and on. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, you know, I was listening to an interview. I can't remember when exactly, but a few weeks after the fall of Kabul to the Taliban, with an Afghan woman activist on the radio. And I forget who it was who was speaking, but one of the people who was interviewing her was like, oh, you know, does this take you back to the Stone Ages now, you know, in terms of women's rights? And she said, well, you know, Afghan women's rights are not something that can be given and taken away. You know, we fight for them. These are our lives and we fight for these rights and we will continue to fight. And you're continuing to see that in Afghanistan, right? Women are bravely going out and protesting despite the return of some very stringent rules by the Taliban, despite some very real restrictions, despite incredible risk to their lives. And that's the kind of stories that we should be talking about and we should be focusing on. And, you know, the United States government might not be thinking about this, and they you know, there's a particular narrative that's put out about the goodness of the American government and the fundamental righteousness of these wars. But I mean, let's not forget, even, you know, certainly before the Iraq War, it was the largest global anti-war protest movement in history. And despite that, the U.S. went to war. So there are voices in this country who have, you know, tried to stand in solidarity with people in other countries, who have sort of, who have that sense of connection, who have raised their voices, and who have stood up against these kinds of policies.
Anjali Kamat is a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. She spoke with three longtime journalists about the so-called war on terror and what it has meant for people in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen. Anjali, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And you can find Anjali's piece at yourcallradio.org with a number of links. Coming up after a break, we will discuss a ProPublica investigation exposing how Facebook undermines privacy protections for its 2 billion WhatsApp users. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.